Welcome back. This is the News Roundup, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves, a news columnist with the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Wanted to talk about a story you had in the paper. Those of us who pay attention to government and financials of different municipalities, we're familiar with override. You're talking about a potential underride to lower the budget to counter school funding increases. Talk about that. What's an underride?
That's correct. An underride is exactly the opposite of an override. As we know, an override increases the tax levy by a set amount, usually permanently, but it can be temporary. In 2012, that's exactly what Harwich did to help finance its share of the new Monomoy Regional School budget. They increased the tax levy by $990,000, almost $1 million. That increase was supposed to be temporary, and at that time, officials anticipated that this coming year, with the full school merger happening, there would be the savings to account for that money, and they could reduce the town levy by tax levy by that amount. Well, those savings haven't materialized as we've seen, and now a Harwich resident named Hugh Drummond has submitted a petition town meeting article for exactly an underride, which will reduce the tax levy to Harwich property owners, in this case by that amount, $990,000. The problem with this, town officials say, is that if an underride passes, they may have to cut town operating expenses by that amount and not the school budget, which is really the target of this, because the town has no control over the school budget. The school department submits a one-line budget item, and the town either funds it or doesn't. They can't reduce that. And Harwich's school assessment this year is actually going up again by about $250,000. Selectmen are saying that let's be careful. This approach could really create havoc with town finances. But it looks like the ultimate say on this could be up to the voters in May.
So, with those savings not coming through with this new school district, what's the frustration level in Harwich and in the involved communities?
It's pretty high. Harwich was expecting a lot of savings because of the merger. But it turns out that they're actually they're paying less than they were, but they're paying they're not paying as less as they expected.
Right.
Harwich is in the district, of course, with Chatham, and Harwich has the majority of students. And the way the financial agreement goes, the proportion of the budget is paid by the proportion of students from each town, and that's actually gone up for Harwich by I think 1%, 1 or 2%.
Mm-hmm.
So they've seen their assessment increase a little bit more than they anticipated. So the frustration level is pretty high. They're hoping that eventually this is all going to pan out because the school system will attract some additional school choice kids once the new high school comes online, and they're really hoping that there'll be some more teacher retirements. There can be some more savings in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, school officials are saying, you may be paying a little bit more, but you're going to end up with a great new school system.
Mm. Let's keep talking about Harwich. The selectmen, we've talked about improvements to Route 124. Now it sounds like, that's a major roadway. Now the selectmen are talking about scaling that back.
It is. It is a major roadway, but it's also considered kind of a nice sort of winding rural road through from Harwich going into Brewster. And the state is proposing state-financed improvements to Pleasant Bay Road, or Route 124, as it's called, in the Pleasant Lake section of town. But the residents there don't like the plan that the state has come forward with, which widens the road and adds sidewalks and bike lanes, and they say will really ruin the feel of the neighborhood. And earlier this week, the Harwich Selectmen unveiled four alternatives for this 1.4-mile stretch of road, which will fix problems that the road has, such as drainage now, but will, they say, retain the sort of country lane nature of the roadway.
Hmm.
They're calling for 11-foot-wide travel lanes, two travel lanes in all of these options, but the options propose different widths for sidewalks and shoulders and bike mm-hmm. lanes and things like that. Now, Harwich selectmen aren't sure how the state is going to treat those proposals, those scaled-back designs, and whether the state will say, well, you know, you have to do it our way or the highway, basically, and whether Harwich will be stuck paying for some of these improvements themselves. They've instructed their engineers to refine some of these design approaches and kind of feel out the state as far as how they feel about them.
Okay. Tim, you know, a lot of us are familiar with the Pendleton rescue story and more than 50 years ago that happened and the role that the Coast Guard played. Now, you're reporting this is going to be a Disney movie as well as an adaptation for young readers in a book form.
That's right. The story of what's called the greatest small boat rescue in the history of the Coast Guard is pretty much legendary around here. And at this point, a few years ago, there was a best-selling book called The Finest Hour by Michael Togias and Casey Sherman, which really told sort of the definitive story about this rescue that happened on February 18th, 1952, when the tanker Pendleton broke up about 60 miles off of Chatham, and a four-man crew left the fish pier here in a 36-foot rescue boat and managed to reach the tanker, rescue 36 of the 37 crewmen, and make it back to Chatham in a boat that was only supposed to hold 12 people. It's a great story,
yeah.
And it seems perfectly suited for the screen, and Togias and Sherman have sold the rights to Disney, and there's a team, I believe they're in pre-production right now, working on this adaptation. There's a tentatively scheduled release date of 2015. There's no other details, really. We don't know who's going to be in it, who's going to direct it. The screenwriters are the folks who did the movie The Fighter, I think, about the Lowell boxer a couple years ago.
Oh, okay. So it is going to be a live-action film. We know that much.
It will be a live-action film, yeah. I imagine with a lot of CGI effects.
Sure.
Also, Togias and Sherman, what prompted our story this week about this is they've taken their best-selling book on the rescue, and they've adapted it for young readers, and it's kind of the perfect story. It's got, you know, adventure and excitement and heroism. It's the perfect story to get young readers interested in Coast Guard and maritime issues and things like that.
Okay, Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thanks, Sean.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Nelson Siegelman. He's the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. He joins us on the phone. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about the propane war on Martha's Vineyard, from low prices to may not last very long, right?
Well, yes. This is sort of an unusual situation, I suppose, because generally speaking, we find that things are more expensive on Martha's Vineyard than on the mainland. Certainly, gas falls into that category. For those of you on the Cape that think you pay high prices, we pay about a dollar more than you do. But on the vineyard, we've been paying about $2.50 or so for propane, which is considerably less than what the state says is the statewide average of about $3.14. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that a company, Rhymes, from Pembroke, New Hampshire, came down to the vineyard a couple of years ago, and they immediately began offering better pricing and in some cases, service than the other two existing propane dealers on the island. So that's been good for islanders because many people at one time used to heat their homes with electricity, and they were getting bills $500-$600 in a month. So you can imagine how that would be a real killer.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's move on. One of the headlines in your paper this week asks a pretty intriguing question. You know, what do young people do on the island in the wintertime?
Right.
Good question. What'd you find? Probably lots of things that they did in the summertime. Fishing.
Yeah. Well, you know, island living, particularly in the winter. I mean, you know, it's easy to come here in the summertime when there's a lot going on, but wintertime it's a little bit different type of lifestyle. I think in general, just generally speaking, you need to be comfortable with yourself, with your friends, and so we thought it'd be interesting to see what that sort of 20 to 30-something group likes to do and how they get by. And we interviewed, we asked a young person, Charlie Nadler, who's grew up here on the vineyard, to speak with some people. You got a variety of answers, and most of them have to do with just things you'd expect would be connected to the island. One fellow says he likes to go, Andrew Jacobs, he likes to go duck hunting in the winter. So that's and he gets together with his friends and they go out and they're outdoors and they shoot ducks and then they come home and cook them. So that's a fun thing. Another fellow, Brian Hall, likes to go out looking on the beach looking for arrowheads. And I think the connection is that people just like to be outdoors and enjoy the quieter setting of a vineyard winter. Another fellow, Michael McCluskey, said he likes to just get together with friends. They do different things. They play board games or watch TV. So no revelations there, but I think it reflects just on the slower pace of the island in the wintertime, and I suspect that what these 30-something, 20, 30-something kids are doing isn't great, much different from what their parents do.
Yeah, I suspect you're probably right, and it's a perennial complaint on the islands as well as here on Cape Cod that there's nothing to do, but I think you find when you go other places, there's nothing to do there either, really. So thank you very much, Nelson. Appreciate it. Nelson
All right,
is the
nice talking to you.
And you too as well. Nelson is the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Sean Gonzalez from the Cape Cod Times is in the studio here in Woods Hole. And one thing, Sean, that we've been covering is Senator Dan Wolf and his bid to run for governor. He suspended that campaign, I think it was 5 months ago now. And he was waiting to hear from the Ethics Commission. And we do have word from the Ethics Commission.
You talk about moving like molasses in January. I mean, from Dan Wolf's perspective, he's nice, so he uses the word bittersweet. But I mean, if we should recap and because this was key. So he's been in the state Senate for a number of years. Before he ran, he disclosed his relationship. Well, he founded Cape Air, their main sort of hub in terms of where they fly from the Cape to is Boston Logan Airport there. And at Logan Airport, every airline that lands at Logan Airport has to pay these preset fees. It's basically the federal government saying, if you want to land here at Logan Airport, you have to pay this fee, period. Well, the Ethics Commission ended up saying in the middle of Dan, several months after Dan Wolf declared that he was going to run for governor, ended up sending him a letter saying that Cape Air's agreement and his relationship to Cape Air means that he has a conflict of interest and that he would have to do one of several things. He had several options. He could divest from the company. He could make Cape Air stop flying into Logan, which would kill the business. Or he could get out of politics. And, that was a huge surprise, not only to Dan Wolf, but to a lot of, across the political spectrum, a lot of people that are business people in it. And I think a number of people were afraid that it would have this chilling effect that would essentially send a message saying, business people don't get into politics in Massachusetts because there could be some shady business here. And Dan Wolf's point all along was, but wait a minute, it's one thing if you're in a position where you can actually use your authority to influence a particular contract that would be good for a business that you have ties to. But when you're talking about an instance like at Massport, where it's not a negotiation, essentially, it's getting a bill essentially from the federal government,
right,
there's no room for influence. So where's the conflict?
Yeah.
So they petitioned, and when I say they, Wolf was able to join a group of some pretty prominent members of in state politics, including former judges, some high profile attorneys. They petitioned the State Ethics Commission to make an exemption, a common sense exemption, really. Well, they did that this week. It'll be formalized when it's published in the state's register, I think later this week or next week. It's too late now for Dan Wolf's campaign because, of course, now with this suspension and this whole ethics cloud having hung over his head early on in his campaign, there's no way to raise that kind of money. Now you've got, Attorney General Martha Coakley's running for governor, so he's out of the governor. The good news for Dan Wolf is that he can remain a Cape and Island senator, and that he can also run for re-election.
Right. That was even in question, whether he would be able to remain in state politics at all. So we've heard from the commission. Okay, that sounds good. Let's talk to Sally Rose now. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Sally, hello.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Well, again, another story that we've been following involves the Board of Selectmen in Provincetown and the involvements of the chairman of the Board of Selectmen there when it came to this whole police brouhaha that blew up this year, which led to the resignation, or I guess the firing, of the police chief.
Right. And there's two pieces of news this week, actually. This last Monday evening, Austin Knight, he served as chair of the Provincetown Board of Selectmen for the last year and a half, and as a board member for several more years than that. He announced he was stepping down as chair just before his colleagues ever had a chance to take it up for a vote. Interestingly, his decision to do that, he said, was based primarily on his mother's ill health. A couple of weeks back, several of his colleagues, even those who had been allied with him on many issues, they made it clear that they were ready to have him step aside as chair. And as you said, this all, of course, comes after it was revealed that last April his election campaign signs were distributed from the police station by former police chief Jeff Geron. That was one of the issues he was fired over. Knight has said publicly that he didn't know that the signs were dispensed from the municipal building, which violates state and town election laws. But there were many who don't believe that statement.
Well, there was an investigation, a report that contradicted him, right?
Yes. There was a privately independent investigation that said that he did seem to know that it was distributed from the station. I guess it was inconclusive about who it was that picked it up from, the connection to that. And then the other piece of news on that end is that the group that's working toward the recall petition accomplished the first step in that process with having the signatures on the affidavit to start that process. Enough were certified to have it go forward this week. And then the town clerk released the recall petitions, and those have to be returned by February 5th with 10% of the registered voters signing, or nearly 300 signatures. And in addition, there was a former local longtime selectman, Cheryl Andrews, announced that she would run for that seat if the recall is successful.
Hi, this is Sean Gonsalves here. Sally, I was just interested to ask you, what do you think, recall petitions, we see them in different towns across the Cape. They're usually unsuccessful in terms of removing selectmen from office. In this case, I guess I'm just curious what your sense is out there in Provincetown. Do you think this is one that actually has a chance to succeed? Is the sense that he will be recalled?
That's an interesting question, Sean. I do think there is a chance. It's a tough threshold to meet, tougher in certain towns. I think in Wellfleet they had to reach 20%. In Provincetown it's just 10. I think some people are a little bit hesitant to take it the full length of the recall. But I think there are also a lot who just want to move forward and feel like that would be a step in helping the town move forward. I think it is possible. Whether it'll happen or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Sally Rose. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Sally, one of the stories in the paper this week regards Highland Light and Truro. I guess the National Seashore has decided not to renew the contract to manage that lighthouse with the nonprofit that's been running it for 20 years. Do we know what's behind that?
Well, it's a little sketchy.
Sure it is.
it was an interesting story. It's the nonprofit group Highland Museum and Lighthouse, Inc. That's the entity that's been responsible for day-to-day maintenance and tourism operations at the Highland Light since 1996. That was when the lighthouse was moved back from the coastal banks where it was eroding, and they were worried it would eventually fall in or off. So the Cape Cod National Seashore essentially, as you said, they cut ties with that group and by allowing the 10-year contract that it's had with the nonprofit to lapse without renewing it, and I guess it lapsed on December 31st. this decision apparently came as a surprise to the nonprofit. Seashore Superintendent George Price would only say that there were operational differences and it was a need for a change. Other than that, he declined to elaborate. Dan Sanders, who's the head of the nonprofit, he shared with us a couple of ideas about why he thinks the relationship may have deteriorated. I think the one that he said broke the camel's back, the straw that broke the camel's back, was when Sanders himself made an unauthorized decision to briefly open the lighthouse for a visiting German tour group during the federal government shutdown.
Oh.
So, yes, oh.
Okay. So we don't know that led to the decision, but he's saying that might have
been
part
of it. One of those things that kind of piled up leading to it.
I see. Now, has another organization been named to maintain the lighthouse? Do we know how that maintenance will go?
Not yet, but the Seashore says they're looking into it. They do have one in particular in mind that does do the same for other landmarks around the country. But, yes, they're still looking into that, and we're thinking that there are likely other reasons that haven't come to light about why this has happened.
Right, most likely. Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. You can read about these stories in the paper this week. Thank you very much, Sally.
Thank you, Sean.
Appreciate it. Sean Gonsalves is here in the studio from the Cape Cod Times. We're going to come back to Sean in just a minute, and we'll be talking about the snow budgets of the towns on the Cape and the islands. But first, this break.